If you don't know Stockland, we're the largest supplier of new housing to the Australian market. We do about 5,500 new housing supply a year, predominantly in the outer areas of the cities of all the capital cities of Australia. And for a number of years in my previous role as head of the Victorian development business, we had often sat at a national executive level and said, this issue of affordability is starting to get away from the market. And over time, we felt that we had to determine what our strategy would be, and we needed to therefore understand the issue a lot better. And we tried to do that as a project, and we tried to do that different ways that corporations do. And we eventually said, no, put somebody in there who's actually experienced in dealing with the commercial side of the business, and that was me. And that started in February. I knew I was going to do that for some time leading up to that, so I started reading. So I've been looking into this full-time on the commercial side, if you like, or on the corporate side for probably 9 months. And the job for me is to develop the strategy for housing affordability at Stockland. And we, at home, we call that the big S, because Lyndall often says, my wife's at the back, and what are you doing now with all this paper and all this internet research and reading? And said, oh, it's the big S, you know. Been quite a big task, and I think if anything I could do today is share with you a way of thinking about it that's actually simpler. I can't believe how much information's out there, and I can also I'm also very encouraged. I haven't had one conversation with Dr. Julian Disney or any of the other speakers today. There is a huge, if you like, consistency in view of the way we're going to move forward. But it's such a big issue. I think one of the challenges is to make it simpler. So hopefully this achieves that a bit. Let's move forward. The way we structured the thinking was, what is the situation, what's the complication it's causing, and what's the resolution? In super summary, it's a structural, not cyclical problem. We've heard that earlier today. The complication for us, when we look at it from an industry point of view, and is as much of a complication as potentially an opportunity, is the rise of the forgotten middle, and I'll talk about that. And the resolution, if you want a simple way of thinking of it, is have half, and I'll talk more about that as a four-point plan. What's the situation? We've seen the charts earlier. The Western world's got this issue. Australia, it's not a unique problem for Australia. In the last, if you like, 10 years, all those ratios have gone north from 3 up to 7s. It's really separated the haves from the have-nots. To me, though, the driver for Australia is simple economic maths. And again, we've had this discussion. It's a bit like Dr. Julian Disney talking about rent and ownership. To me, the same with demand and supply. It's just the correlation or the relationship between the two. So demand, and we've seen this, that's the immigration charts for a number of years. It's just been going absolutely through the roof. It has to. We're at peak labour in this country, probably peak labour in most of the Western world. The same reason the retirement business is a boom industry is the same reason that, in reality, our government has to face up to higher levels of immigration progressively over the next decade plus, as more and more people leave the workforce and are staying in, if we want to maintain our living standards. And I think, sadly, we continually underestimate the population requirements of immigration and therefore its impact to underlying demand, and we've heard that. They're the immigration numbers after the extra 37,500 immigrants that will land in this country starting 30 days ago on the 1st of July, signed off in the May budget. So it'll be roughly 210,000. I wonder when the first house will be delivered for the first of those new arrivals, probably in about 3 years' time at best. So demand, there are other drivers. Yes, I agree. But I think the big variable driver going forward is immigration. I think credit is credit now, and there will be access to credit. It has had an impact to now. Household formation, that's fairly predictable. It's fairly flat and stable. It's still going in one direction. But this is the one that, to me, has the biggest impact. And we need to actually fess up as a particularly government and say, let's really own up to how much immigration this country needs, because we haven't done that. Supply. When we studied this whole topic, I went to the UK, and I'm going to have an occasional glass of water because of the flu. And I said, they said, well, how could you have affordable housing problem in Australia? I said, well, there's this demand issue on immigration, that really we've got a shortage of urban land. They laugh at me. And I was meeting in House of Lords, and they're saying, short of urban land. And I found a statistic. Australia has urbanised 0.3% of its land mass. You could pick up every city, every country town and stick it into that white box in Tasmania. And then when you put that into perspective and you look at the size of the country and you go, well, how could we have an urban land problem? And we do. And it's really bad planning. We have not planned to accommodate and build capacity in this country for probably 50 years, maybe longer. And back to that simple economic mass, demand is much greater than supply and the cost of delivering that supply is going up. So the raw land costs have gone up because of the demand, the supply constraint. Development charges we've heard about from the HIA speech. Engineering standards have gone up. How we build our roads, councils don't want to be fixing roads in 20 years' time. They'd rather fix them in 40 years' time, so the standard of the road's gone up. Five-star homes does cost more at the moment. Hopefully it won't longer term. Labour costs have gone up. Holding costs have gone up because the thing takes so long to get approved. And the upshot of that, and we've seen all this, the top charts, real house prices versus household incomes, household incomes, and it's that separation. And the bottom chart is the same about rents and incomes separating. And it's that separation that's causing all of the problems that we're facing. And it starts with ownership, it moves into rental, and it ends up at the pointy end at homelessness. And it's just a cascade effect. So it's a structural, not a cyclical issue. Totally agree with all the previous speakers. What's the complication? And I'm putting the industry hat on here, but I think this little chart serves two purposes. I better explain it. I was obsessed when I got into thinking about this, about, well, what can a people afford? What can they afford? How many people can afford X to Y in this country? So I started to play around with ABS statistics and created this chart. So if you take this middle band, the yellow one, there's 10 deciles there, so from the zero incomes to the highest incomes. And taking into account someone's tenure, do they own a house already with a mortgage, or do they own a house without a mortgage, or are they renting? And extrapolating our purchasing power as the profile. And so in the middle here, you've got 471,000, or 11%, it's deciles, it should be close to 10%. There's 471,000 households in this country, in capital cities, who can afford between 260,000 and 360,000, and generally got incomes between 55 and 100. When you think about that sort of middle area, you've got government assistance focused at the left-hand side of the ledger, and that new housing supply, it's probably not right out the right-hand side, but definitely the industry's been far more focused at the right-hand side of the ledger. And so these guys in the middle are sort of caught between nowhere. They don't get much government assistance, I say limited. Keystart and Homestart and WA and South Australia are probably your two examples, and increasingly some more coming to the table. But there's limited new supply at that price point, if you take Melbourne out of the picture. Very limited new supply at those price points. So, to me, we have a role as the private sector to target this area. It's a broad demographic. It's key workers, yes. It's first-home buyers, young families, yes. It's probably 3 out of 4 retiring baby boomers, which is a scary statistic coming out of Canberra. That's why they're so worried about how to pay for that. And it's actually quite broad, much broader than I thought it was, and it's getting deeper as petrol prices have their impact, as energy prices will increase the cost to power your house, as food prices go up. And it'll actually capture more people up the curve, if you like. Another way of looking at the same issue, this is the bands of, if you like, purchasing power. So that fifth is the same yellow band. They have a purchasing power between 260 and 360. And I've put on here the average house and land offer that Stockland had in the market on the 30th of June this year, like 30 days ago. So in Victoria, we were averaging about 400,000 by the time we took our land and did a hypothetical build price. It was 400,000, just above the forgotten middle, if you like. New South Wales, Queensland, WA, and we're in all the outer growth areas of those markets. We're closer to 500. We're north of 500,000, and we are just one of the main participants in the new supply market, probably the biggest. So we looked at us, have looked at ourselves, and said, "Well, there is an opportunity here. We could diversify our markets and grow our markets, and actually be part of the solution, not part of the problem. The real issue is in those states that on average they've got to drop the package price by $150,000 to get down into the purchasing power of this unserviced market. So, what's the resolution? And this is the $64,000 question, I suppose. Have half is a concept that just sort of finally landed. You've got your haves and your have-nots. Have half. Have half the house with half the taxes and half the equity. If you wanted somewhere to a way to think about the problem and direct your energies, I think that concept can actually simplify everything that we look at. And as a result of that, there's four different ideas. Before I get to the ideas, though, I had to oversee a group of guys in our business who won an award this year to study housing affordability across the globe. And they went to Japan, Netherlands, Germany, UK, US and Australia and did a whole lot of work to get that. It's an in-house sort of fellowship, and I led their efforts. They produced this concept, which I thought was really quite interesting, saying that a house is made up of three fundamental elements of cost. There's land, what's the land cost, the build, and the taxes. And that gives you a market price. And then they said, well, someone can come up with a deposit and they can get a loan against that. And for some, and for increasingly number of people, they're sort of getting to this what they can afford. And then there's this gap. And you call that the affordability gap. I thought, oh, that's a nice start. That actually makes a bit of sense. And then they came up with this other idea and said, well, there's two ways to fix that gap. One is to fill it, and essentially it's an equity assistance solution. And I'll talk more about how you do that without driving demand. But grant funding is part of that. NRAS is part of that. Shared equity is part of that. The other way, and I think the most important aspect in the short term, is to reduce the absolute cost of housing for this number of people, or for these buyers. Smaller homes is absolutely number one thing we've got to do. And I'll talk more about that. I'm quite passionate about that topic, and there's some people who do it better than others in our industry. Approval reform, we've heard a bit about that, and it was good to hear Dr. Julian Disney. I've read a lot of his work. Tax rebalance is the other third piece to actually reducing and shrinking that gap. So it is an integrated approach, and I think every one of these levers has to be pursued. Some of them are short-term, some of them long-term. So let's just go through these four and then I'm done. Shrink the gap, smaller homes, resolution number one. Certainly from our point of view it is. It's the thing we control most, and we are moving ahead in this direction. There hasn't been a lot of innovation in small homes in the new supply of housing for a long time, at least a decade, not through greed, but I say through laziness. It's been a boom market, and the industry's just been busy enough just supplying that demand and hasn't had to innovate generally to do well. In Adelaide, yes, innovation's a bit more competitive. There's always a lot more innovation coming out of Adelaide because it's far more competitive. It's interesting. But the industry has to move to marketing. Big is not better. And I think the government could assist in some ways. The other thing I threw into this side of what the industry needs to do is look at some modern methods of construction. It was touched on by the minister. Excuse me. These are real logos from Japan. Toyota are building homes out of factories and building them in a day. And then 30 days later, erecting them in a day to lock up and fitting them out 30 days later. If you can take 18 weeks out of a build program, save someone 18 weeks in rent that they've got while they're still renting where they are now or owning, you can save a significant amount of money. Panna Homes, IKEA Homes. We haven't had a lot of, I don't think, building industry, building homes, innovation. We're still pretty much, we moved from bare and post to slab in the last 50 years. That's about it. Land sizes have reduced generally, but not as much as they can. So I think that's another component that the industry can do, coupling with smaller homes to get it's acting and get a bit of innovation in that space. But I did read something, and I will give credit again to Dr. Julian Disney, and I linked these two. Urban infrastructure is a big problem in this country. A lot of people said to me when I pushed this into the business and externally, oh, but Australians love their big homes. Well, I say that I don't believe it. You go down to Paran, live in a dog box, got a really good job, probably work at KPMG. Doesn't bother them there. Why is that? Because they can go everything at their doorstep. Why? Instead of moving the people to the jobs, let's move the jobs to the people. So I think this country needs a national settlement plan. It needs to know its numbers on immigration. It needs to understand that population size progressively. And then it needs to think more seriously about decentralisation, whether that's regions and growth areas, and getting the urban infrastructure out there so that we can have train lines to growth areas like Mernda, Melton, instead of just having people pumping out there and they don't have that infrastructure. Once you've got the train lines out there, you can build the density, the amenity, the jobs. And the picture there is St Kilda Road. What better example? Just go for a walk down there. 1860 that was, surveyed. 1860. It is a 14-lane super freeway. If you think about it, if you add all the lanes that you park your car with, 46 years later, the first tram went down the middle. They were planning for the future capacity of this country back then, and we haven't done it for too long. And hopefully this Build Australia Fund will leverage its $20 billion to get its act together in this regard from an urban infrastructure point of view. The more we do urban infrastructure, the more people, the more small homes we can deliver into the market. It's just that simple. Because you'll attract a whole new demographic to go, heck, I can get it cheap, and I can get everything I want at my doorstep. It's just in a different location. Have half the house. Approval reform, at the risk of being controversial. Separation of powers at local level. It seems just unusual to me that we have a democratic society where we have people making rules up at Spring Street, and then we have a court system to judge applications or judge rulings against those rules that were established up at Spring Street. Separation of powers. We have it at a federal level, we have it at a state level, but we don't have it at a local level. So the poor local councillors are completely conflicted every second of their elected lives. It is an absolute waste in our society. And how many applications just go through the process, waste time, waste energy, and end up just at some other panel or VCAT or whatever it wants to be in every single jurisdiction in this country? It's just a waste. It's unnecessary. It's a conflict of interest that we should remove, and we can't. We have to protect and expand the non-building union industry. It is the most efficient way to build a house in this country by some way. We have to remove barriers to building small homes. There are examples in local councils in Sydney where they'll tell you the size of the bedroom you're allowed to have, how many bedrooms they'd like to see. Obviously, the usual suspects like setbacks, site coverage on the lot. If we've all got to get on the same page here, if this is the answer or part of the answer, then stop putting local barriers in place and start allow the market to, if the market thinks, if the industry thinks it can develop, you know, like in Japan, someone's going to sleep in a cube, then let them have a go. I mean, if they don't sell it, they don't sell it. Let the market have it, make its decisions about dictating that sort of product initiative. Don't allow the councils to do sort of lowest common denominator rules and therefore inhibit the innovation. It does happen. It's happening today. It'll happen tomorrow. And view inclusionary zoning as a last resort. I didn't have this view before I went to the UK and spent 2 weeks there. I spoke to a range of people, every part of the industry, government, housing associations, developers, you name it. The biggest problem with inclusionary zoning is the risk it has on inflating house prices. Because if it's unfunded in any way, it will inevitably land as an increase to the open market price of the house. I've got this little chart, it's not very sophisticated, but if you think of the property clock, at the top of the clock, you've got lots of supply. The market can pay more generally, and we've seen. And the vendor who owns the underlying land, he's not discounting his land. He's putting his land price up. As the property clock moves to the bottom of the clock, which Sydney's been there for some time, supply dries up. The market can't afford to pay much more. But the vendor doesn't necessarily correlate that he'll discount his land. Because unless he's a forced seller, he'll just wait for the clock to come round the top again. So what I heard in the UK was a lot about, well, because it's a blanket rule, there's this unfunded component, what will happen is all of the developers will factor it in and the vendor will accept a lower price. It hasn't happened for the last 10 years, and I doubt it's going to happen right now. So there is risk of having supply issues and open market inflation. It may be necessary in some locations, in some pockets, but be very, very careful. What's the industry got to do? I think the industry is very disjointed on approval reform. It really does need to unite and say what is a collective solution to this, rather than everyone's got their different idea. The main issue here, and we've heard it in a few spots, is remove and avoid inflationary intervention. It does exist, and we've got to avoid making what we think is the right decision, and it ends up impacting open market housing to compensate for that intervention, which is a vicious cycle that does happen. Tax rebalance, mainly a government initiative. There's all the modelling areas. I've remiss of me not to put negative gearing on there. You know, first-time owners grant, how infrastructure's funded, stamp duty, land tax, capital gain, it's all going to happen. Tax Review 2020 is going to look at all the property taxes. I'm not going to propose what the answer is, because there's much better brains to do that. However, I've put some thought to what would be the objectives or a test for a good answer in each of these areas. So with a first-time owners grant, it's got to be set so it doesn't inflate demand, as it has done for 12 years or however long it's been in place. The fact that it hasn't been capped to price is just insane. I heard an example, and I know my Metricom friends might be here today. They shared one with me 3 years ago. A couple came out from South Africa. One was on $250,000. The other one was about $175,000. They bought a $1.2 million house in Malvern and dutifully put in their first homeowner's grant application. That's just wrong. Infrastructure, the benefit of infrastructure and the burden of paying for it has to be shared. It's got to be equitable. It's not. So we go out in the new areas and all the new homeowners, they pay for all the new libraries, the new schools, the new everything. All the guys that are in the established suburbs, 3Ks, 4Ks down the road, they don't pay for it, but they get the benefit. That's not right. We didn't have that system, I think, 20, 30 years ago. Happy to stand corrected. That has to be reassessed because that is a massive issue, more so in New South Wales than in Victoria, but it's a growing concern. Stamp duty is just such an inefficient tax. I mean, you know, if you're going to get people in a small home, then they're probably going to grow out of that in due course. If you've still got stamp duty every time you transact, it's just a disincentive. How many people are hanging back going, I'll buy the end house as my first house? That really has to be reassessed. Land tax. I suspect land tax might be the difference between global capital owning residential real estate and not. If you think about it, let's say yields are 4%. Land tax, most states, it's 2% on the land, which will be about 1% on the end product. That's 25% of the return. And that could be the difference between getting global capital into supplying investment stock or not. Capital gains, whatever does happen there, it does need to encourage new supply over existing, and I think Julian Disney covered that off very well. Means testing is underrated. I think, you know, means testing or capping is a way to get around putting these incentives in and they just become a demand driver. I think WA have done that quite well, and South Australia. Have half the taxes. And the last one, a bit more complex, equity assistance. This is going to be a bit of a journey, I think, for our country. Filling the gap idea. What's happening right now is the government is trying to capitalise the not-for-profit sector. In Victoria, there's been these stock transfers. I think the National Rental Affordability Scheme may very well be more viable for a tax charitable tax status than a non-charitable tax status. So I think they're actually doing the right thing, getting the non-for-profit community housing sector capitalised. What the industry needs to do is partner. And so my recommendation to our business is who are the best of breed and aligned to our business that we can partner with to match the land to their service and solution and product. I think next that steps down. Federally, I think this concept of shared equity is a proven winner. The federal government should have an origination fund for shared equity, just like we see in South Australia and WA. We don't do it in Melbourne or in Sydney because there's memories of the late 80s when a different design system blew up in their face, but it's actually Not the same. It's probably the same as that negative gearing argument, hanging on to old lessons, which is a different story today. What the industry should be doing is helping distribute that originated shared equity by government. And then the government, after time, can step back and underwrite shared equity and allow the industry to originate. And I think over this little chart here, over time, we'll get more and more volume of this solution into the market. It'll start with, number one, it's a new housing offer only. It's a rental solution, mainly through non-for-profits, and it's that grant funding in the various guises that's building that up. That then moves into for-profit, so you get a little bit bigger market reach. Then it goes into all of the above things, plus shared equity via government, gets a bit bigger reach again. Finally, the for-profits find it viable. P.S. Westpac may get a fund up in the shorter term. I suspect not, given the current climate, but eventually it'll happen. And finally, allow that solution to get into the established markets as well as all of the preceding, as long as it's targeted to the people in the need. And that'll grow. So have half the equity. So that's really it. Situation, house prices, they're underwritten by that basic economic equation. Demand much greater than supply, input costs rising. Complications is forgotten middle. It's a growth market for the industry. We should be excited about this opportunity rather than worrying about it. It's actually a growth market. And they're viable $50,000 to $100,000 incomes. And the resolution, have half, starting with half the house, and the other stuff will follow. Thanks very much.